Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are now just 24 days left until Election Day, and political analysts say Donald Trump's path to the presidency is narrowing as Hillary Clinton strengthens her lead in key swing states. As for control of the Senate, it's anybody's guess at this point, and it'll come down to Senate races in states like New Hampshire, where Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte is facing a tough challenge from Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan. Anthony Brooks of Here and Now contributor WBUR has our story.
Earlier this week, Democrat Maggie Hassan brought her campaign for the U.S. Senate to the W.H. Bagshaw factory in Nashua, New Hampshire, the oldest pin manufacturer in the country.
Now, as you've heard and know, I'm running for the United States Senate for a couple of reasons.
It looked and sounded like a normal political campaign as Hassan toured the factory, shook hands, and spoke to workers. But like many political contests this fall, this hasn't been a normal campaign because of the long shadow cast by Donald Trump.
I'd look her right in that fat, ugly face.
I moved in her like a... I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it.
This is part of a new online ad from the Hassan campaign seeking to link her Republican opponent, Senator Kelly Ayotte, to Trump. Trump poses a challenge for many Republicans across the country. For most of her campaign, Ayotte has said, somewhat awkwardly, that she'd vote for Trump, but not endorse him. Then, at a debate last week, she was asked if she'd tell a child that Trump is a role model.
Well, I think that certainly there are many role models that we have, and I believe he's can serve as president, and so absolutely, I would do that.
After the debate, Ayotte said she misspoke and that neither Donald Trump nor Hillary Clinton are role models. But when the 11-year-old recording of Trump bragging about kissing, groping, and assaulting women surfaced last weekend, Ayotte finally dumped Trump.
I cannot vote for Donald Trump based on what he has said and done and the actions he talked about in those tapes. And I want my daughter to know that. That is more important to me than winning any election.
Ayotte says she will write in the Republican VP candidate, Mike Pence, for president, and suggested that her decision not to vote for Trump is based on principle. But in Nashua this week, her opponent, Maggie Hassan, disagreed.
What I would ask her is, why now? And I think the answer is very clear, that this is a political calculation on her part. She's trying to walk back her support because she understands it could cost her politically.
It might well have cost Ayotte politically to go on supporting Trump, but it could also cost her to drop him.
Well, I think it was a grave tactical error on Senator Ayotte's part.
This is Lou Gargiulo, a businessman from Exeter, New Hampshire, and a county chairman for the Trump campaign. Gargiulo says now he has real reservations about voting for Ayotte, and he says she risks losing lots of Trump supporters like him.
Plenty of people say things in a crude manner privately, a private conversation. I'm not overly troubled by it. Should it not have been said? Absolutely. But is that the reason to vote or not to vote for him? I don't view it as a litmus test.
And here's why Gargiulo says what Trump said on those tapes should not disqualify him.
One only has to look at social media to see that he's taken a lot of negative incoming from Trump supporters and others who think at this late date to come out with such a statement was not in her best interest or the best interest of the Republican Party.
But many Republicans disagree with that and are abandoning Trump, from U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan to Kelly Ayotte to New Hampshire GOP Chairman Jennifer Horne, who's telling party members to vote their conscience, even if it means not supporting Trump. But in a close race, in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans, Ayotte needs all the Trump supporters she can get. A new poll from WBUR out today has her tied with Maggie Hassan. Here's Fergus Cullen, the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party.
So the math works out that if she loses 1 out of 10 Trump voters who decline to vote for her, that ends up to be 3 or 4 points of a general election audience, and she clearly doesn't have 3 or 4 points to spare.
Cullen has never supported Trump, but he supports Ayotte and says she was caught in a difficult political position between Trump supporters and more moderate independents.
Kelly Ayotte was never supporting Trump. She never appeared with him at any events. Many times she has spoken out against him. And I think her position was actually politically courageous.
But now, Cullen says Ayotte is at risk of being dragged down with the wreckage of the Trump campaign, along with lots of other Republicans across the country. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Well, we're also watching a House race in Wisconsin, but the incumbent, Paul Ryan, has other things on his mind. He's, of course, Speaker of the House, the youngest in 150 years, wresting that role with the backing of conservative Republicans from John Boehner a year ago. But you won't see Ryan standing with the party's standard bearer, Donald Trump. How is Ryan handling this delicate dance of endorsing his party's candidate, but saying, as he did this week, that he won't defend or support him? Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, it's a war between Ryan and Trump. Isn't that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, it's a war. There's a civil war going on within the party. And now the rift, the on-again, off-again rift between Ryan and Trump is very much on-again.
Yeah. And this week, Ryan distanced himself after that 2005 tape in which Trump bragged about grabbing women's crotches. Trump tweeted out that Ryan was disloyal, weak, and ineffective. So tell, you know, remind us who Paul Ryan is. Why is it so impossible, in particular for him, to side with Trump?
Well, I mean, you couldn't find a Republican sort of more different in personality, style, vision of the party, and even on some major issues than Ryan is from Trump. I mean, it's an interesting combination. He is more conservative than Trump in many respects. He's a traditional kind of conservative in a lot of ways, very conservative economically. He's to the right of Trump on things like entitlements. He's to the left of Trump on immigration. So he combines his conservatism and his ideology with this sort of big tent Republican notion of outreach. He's got a district that, while it's Republican, is not overwhelmingly Republican. It contains some Democratic cities, including one with an African-American population. So he sees himself as an outreach Republican, a very conservative Republican, but one that's trying to broaden the coalition. So you can imagine how Donald Trump kind of is a jarring juxtaposition with that in so many respects.
Well, also a family man, a Catholic, how much is that a part of this?
Yeah, I think he's got kids. He's, I remember being at the post-election when he was elected speaker, he had a reception at the Library of Congress for he invited people in both parties, and John Boehner got up and jokingly used an expletive in a speech in which he was kind of teasing Ryan. And Ryan was like, you know, went in a sort of mock shock and pointed out that his teenage daughter was standing right behind Boehner. So he does have this kind of old-fashioned straight-lacedness, I would say. And it's easy to imagine him being just appalled by not only some of Trump's rhetoric, but obviously by the accusations against Trump.
Well, we should say you don't have to be a conservative to be offended if the ex-Speaker of the House uses an expletive in front of your teenage daughter.
But yeah, I mean, it was a humorous moment. But Ryan is honestly that kind of guy. And so, I mean, this makes this such a nightmare, I think, on all sorts of levels. He's got relationships with people on both sides of the Trump divide. Reince Priebus is a good friend of his who's been sticking by Trump. They come from the same part of Wisconsin.
He's, of course, the head of the RNC.
The head of the RNC. He's got mentors who are never Trump people and others who have been Trump loyalists. It's just a very tortured, I mean, like it is for a lot of Republicans, but particularly for him, it's a tortured situation.
Well, so how is this playing out in Wisconsin? We're going to take a closer look at this congressional race, you know, down the road as we follow different races. But what are people there saying? Wisconsin had always had a reliably intact, tight Republican Party.
Yeah, so it's very jarring to see the discord within the Republican Party today. Obviously, it's happening nationally, but in Wisconsin, where you had a great deal of solidarity between, for example, the Tea Party and the party establishment, conservative talk radio, party officials, groups. I mean, everybody was kind of working in concert, particularly through Governor Scott Walker's recall conflicts and election fights. And now that's kind of all out the window. I mean, Republicans are all over the map. The other interesting thing about Wisconsin is that it was a terrible state for Donald Trump in the primary. I mean, Donald Trump suffered arguably his worst primary defeat anywhere in Wisconsin late in the process before he ran the table and assured himself of the nomination. And then when he inserted himself into Paul Ryan's primary in August on behalf of a pro-Trump, anti-Ryan Republican challenger, Ryan blew his opponent out of the water. So he's got a lot of goodwill and support in Wisconsin, a state that hasn't been particularly pro-Trump. And in fact, if you look at the polling, the people who like Ryan in Wisconsin actually are a little bit more anti-Trump than pro-Trump. So he's managed to straddle this divide, but he also has a lot to lose because to whatever extent, you know, the people that like Trump perceive him as disloyal, that's going to cost him. And to whatever extent the people that don't like Trump perceive him as insufficiently distancing himself, that could also cost him politically.
Boy, this is just a fascinating time for Paul Ryan.
Yeah, I don't think Paul Ryan would call it that.
Right. Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
We've been talking about K through 12 education this week. We heard from the Teacher of the Year.
Generally, when I meet my students, I believe in them more than they believe in themselves. And then over time, I have to convince them that, you know, they can do whatever they set their mind to.
We talked about inequality in education.
We still have entrenched patterns of racial and socioeconomic isolation, especially in urban areas.
And we had a debate about charter schools.
Families are voting with their feet, and they are choosing the charter school, the effective charter schools, more and more. And so I think you have to have that pressure there. If you take that off, then what is the incentive for the, you know, existing status quo to change itself? There really is none.
You can find all those conversations at hereandnow.org. And as we wrap up our series, let's look to the future and where the presidential candidates stand on education reform with Anya Kamenetz, NPR's education blogger. Hi, Anya.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. And, you know, education hasn't been a prominent issue in this presidential campaign, but Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump do differ on their plans for improving schools. Trump wants to expand school choice. Here he is speaking in September, laying out his plan at a charter school in Cleveland.
As president, I will establish the national goal of providing school choice to every American child living in poverty. That means that we want every disadvantaged child to be able to choose the local public, private, or charter school, a magnet school, any of these schools that is best for them and for their family.
Anya, tell us more about how that would work.
Well, Trump's plan has been called sort of a reheated version of the GOP reform agenda from, you know, up to like 10 years ago. The recipe of vouchers, of expanded choice, and of charter school programs is something that actually isn't really so much part of the consensus anymore. And the irony was brought home by the fact that the place that he chose to make that announcement was actually a failing charter school that had gotten an F from the state. Charter schools are, you know, still on an expansion in some states, but there's also increasing pushback. And I would say a fraying of what was once a bipartisan coalition about the best ways to improve education that was led and championed by many conservatives doesn't have the same support that it did maybe 10 years ago.
And when we talk about a voucher program, just explain how that would work. So would everybody in the country, if they didn't want to go to their local public school, then they would get a voucher to go to a different school?
Well, voucher programs tend to work on the state level because most K-12 funding happens on the state level. The federal government plays a very small role in that. And in the places where voucher programs have been put into place, they have very uneven results. So the idea is, yes, you can basically take your money with you, your per-head funding, and go to a private school, a religious school, an online charter school. And depending on how these programs are designed, they oftentimes end up with worse outcomes for students that take advantage of them.
And Hillary Clinton is opposed to school voucher programs. She says Trump's proposal would decimate public schools across the country. What is her plan for education reform?
So Hillary, when it comes to education, her deepest level of conviction really is in pre-K. So she talks a lot about early Head Start. She wants to double the federal funding for early Head Start, Head Start. She wants to make pre-K universal for four-year-olds. When it comes to K-12, she's been a bit more circumspect. I mean, she's talking about sort of softer proposals like computer science for all. And I think the reasoning behind that is that, as I mentioned before, there's not as much of a consensus on the best way to make schools better, even among Democrats. So you have a situation right now where You know, movements like Black Lives Matter, the NAACP are calling for a moratorium on the expansion of charter schools. And teachers' unions, which have been very supportive of Clinton, you know, the heads of the largest teachers' unions are both very strong Clinton surrogates. And so what their agenda is to expand public schools, to expand pay for teachers, to expand funding, and to kind of pull back the throttle on accountability and testing and some things that are really even the mainstay of the Obama education agenda.
And on the issue of pre-K, this is something that President Obama has been a big fan of, calling for universal pre-K. Where does Donald Trump stand on that?
We haven't heard too much from him on pre-K specifically. He's called for, you know, expansion of paid leave for parents, which is an interesting proposal for the, from the GOP. There was one speech by his daughter talking about the need to expand paid leave. But on specifically pre-K, we haven't heard too much.
Have the candidates come down on the issue of Common Core?
Yes. Donald Trump has picked up, again, on some very strong sentiment within the GOP against the Common Core. So he's tweeted about how he's very opposed to the Common Core. If you search for Common Core on Twitter, you'll find many avowed Trump supporters talking about the dangers of the Common Core. It's interesting when you look at public opinion in general. There was a report that came out, a national survey in the beginning of the school year, saying that Americans' approval of the Common Core has really plummeted in the few years since it's been introduced. However, their negative reactions are very tied to the name Common Core. And if you ask them, do you think that the same standards should be in schools in different states, there's a lot more approval for that idea. But of course, that is what the Common Core is. It's just the name itself is really seeming to become kind of toxic.
Anya Kamenetz, NPR's education blogger. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And while we're talking about the future of education, let's talk about the teachers of the future and the training they will get. Are teachers being trained the way they should be? Francesca Forzani is Deputy Director of Teaching Works at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what kind of training are teachers required to have in the U.S. today before they actually start teaching? And does it vary from state to state?
It does vary from state to state. For the most part, teachers are required to have some training in the subject they're going to teach and some kind of training in the practice of teaching and a little bit generally in what is known as education foundations, including education psychology.
And when training a teacher, what are the kinds of things that they would learn, let's say, just about teaching in general, not about the subject matter?
Well, again, it varies. In a lot of programs, teachers tend to get a lot of opportunity to study teaching from a kind of outsider's perspective, kind of the problems of schools, the challenges that students face, a little bit about the history of teaching. What we worry about at Teaching Works is the extent to which they learn to actually do teaching, to practice the work that actual teachers get to do to the point of competence.
Why do you worry about that?
Well, for decades in the United States, most people who prepare to become teachers have not had a whole lot of opportunity to practice the actual work with close coaching and feedback. So there's been a little bit of shift more in the direction of more practice-focused training in the past 10 years or so, but it still is, I think, a pretty significant gap in teachers' training. It's a very odd gap because what would you learn to do when you're learning to become a teacher but teach? But the fact is that a lot of people actually don't learn to teach or don't learn it as well as we would want them to.
They're not able to spend time in actual classrooms and just have somebody give them feedback.
Most people learning to teach do spend time in actual classrooms, but there's a real difference between sitting in the back of a classroom and watching what's happening or even interacting with kids and actually learning to teach. So you can imagine sitting in an operating theater and watching a surgery happen. That does not mean you actually know how to do the surgery yourself. So there's a far cry from just being in a classroom to learning how to do the work of teaching. People don't learn by osmosis.
You were a high school English teacher for 4 years in Mississippi with Teach for America. Did you know a lot before you went into that experience, or is that where you learned, or how much training did you have?
Well, Teach for America back in 1998 when I joined was in a very different place than it is now. I had 5 weeks of training, which I don't think was adequate, and I don't think anybody at Teach for America thought it was adequate either. I learned the basics, but I didn't learn enough. I learned quite a bit more once I got in the classroom, which was not very fair to my students.
Well, that's kind of a conundrum, though, isn't it? That it's not fair to your students to have you learning by actually doing it, but at the same time, as you say, actually doing it is one of the best ways to learn.
It is, but it's not so much of a conundrum when you think that there are ways of supporting people and supervising people in a classroom. So I don't mean that prospective teachers shouldn't get in the classroom. They absolutely should. There's no other way to really learn how to teach but to be in there doing it. But they should have appropriate experiences outside of a K-12 classroom before they get in the classroom, and chances to practice what they're doing in simulated situations with their peers, and then probably in situations with small groups of kids and with an experienced teacher watching what they're doing before they really assume full responsibility for a classroom.
So when you look at the problems that exist in our education system in this country, and we see the statistics that show the U.S. in some cases falling behind other places in the world, how much of that do you think has to do with the training of the teachers?
Well, it's obviously a very complex problem with a lot of factors influencing what happens to a kid and how much a child learns and learns to do. But I think the evidence is pretty clear that quality teaching is one of the most significant factors. I think it's a big problem that there's no national standard for teacher training. It's quite true that children and communities vary significantly across the United States, but the work that goes into teaching all different kinds of kids is really not that different from one place to the next. So I see no reason why we can't come to some minimal amount of agreement about what teachers need to be able to do in the classroom, whether they are in urban California or a rural community in Mississippi.
That's Francesca Forzani, who is Deputy Director of Teaching Works at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, you can hear our entire education series at our website, hereandnow.org, and you can weigh in there as well with your thoughts. Bloomberg News reports that the era of cheap airfare is coming to an end because of rising fuel and labor costs. Mike Regan is a columnist with Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this assumes that we were in the era of cheap airfare. I feel like that went away a little while ago. But this is in part based on an earnings report from Delta, which said what?
Well, you know, airlines love to use a jargon, and the piece of jargon that got everyone's attention this time is what's known as ASM, which is available seat miles. And what that means is if you take all the flights that the airline plans to run and, you know, add up all the seats within those flights and then multiply it by the number of miles they plan to fly, you get something known as available seat miles. And it had been that metric had been growing very strongly in recent years. And Delta said, we're going to curtail that growth to about 1% for the rest of this year and all the way through 2017. And so that 1% compares to a growth rate of this type of capacity that was closer to 6 to 8% over the last few years. So this is a pretty steep pullback on the growth in capacity for airline.
And less capacity means less supply, more demand, fuller planes, and I guess they can charge what they want.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, economics 101, supply and demand. As they reduced the growth in supply of available seats, it's, you know, the idea is that it boosts prices.
And they're saying that labor costs are part of this. Why is that?
Well, Delta is in negotiations and signed a tentative deal to increase salary for pilots by about 30%. And obviously, you know, labor is one of the biggest costs for an airline, as well as fuel. And fuel prices recently have been on the rebound, too.
Fuel prices on the way up, as crude oil is now around $50 a barrel, which is about twice what it was back in January. So that is likely to lead to higher prices as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the airlines enjoyed very low the benefits of very low oil prices for a couple years there, but oil is now inching back up above $50, so you can count on those fuel costs to go up.
So let's go back to that original premise that we were in an era of cheap airfare. What are fares like right now compared to recent years?
Well, there's a website, Hopper.com, that tracks these things, and they put the average domestic airfare at about $216 in September. And for comparison, it was more than $270 at the same time in 2013. So the low fuel costs and this really large increases in capacity are really drove prices down over the years.
Meanwhile, we've just had another report in the last 24 hours of one of those big computer glitches, this time at United Airlines, that caused a lot of delays, actually thousands of passengers involved in that. This comes after Delta said it lost $100 million in revenue from a big computer glitch over the summer. Are airlines putting more money into the technology to fix this kind of thing?
I assume, you know, I would assume any time an airline or any company is going to lose $100 million because of an outage like that, it's going to cause everyone in the industry to take notice. In Delta's case, it was actually a power control system in its computer center in Atlanta that failed. And that basically shut down electricity to about 300 of their 7,000 computer servers.
That's Mike Regan of Bloomberg Gadfly. And this is Here and Now.
The Republican Party is in a fight for its soul. One scholar argues that history might give us some guidance as to who will win and how we got here. Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College. Her 2014 book is To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. She joins us in the studio. And Professor, the thing that's brought on this round of soul searching is, of course, that tape of Donald Trump bragging about groping women. Some leaders are backing away from him. Some have returned to the Trump fold. But your thoughts on what it all means?
Well, that tape represents a certain moment in the GOP that's been a long time coming. And what that does is it knocks a hole in the narrative that has managed to control the Republican Party since about the 1990s, but has been building since actually way back to the 1930s. And that was predicated on an image of a traditional family, of a breadwinning man who could protect his wife and his children against the grasping immigrants, African Americans, and women who wanted government handouts. Well, that kind of language worked until Donald Trump came out as a sexual predator.
That shattered something.
It shattered the beliefs among the people who've supported the Republican Party that their leaders had their best interests in mind. People who were voting Republican and who were voting to put people like the current Republican leaders in power are good people who believe that they were doing what was good for America and defending a traditional America. And what that moment did is it revealed that, in fact, what the leaders were doing was very different than what the rank and file were doing. And this is the moment when the rank and file takes their party back, but takes it back not necessarily in the thuggish way that the white nationalists would take it, but rather takes it back to an old-fashioned traditional republicanism, which is what they believed in all along.
Remind us, traditional republicanism.
Well, you know, traditional republicanism grew up in the 1850s as opposed to the Democrats, who always saw the world kind of as an us versus them proposition, that the world was limited, the economy was limited, and there was always a group of people who needed to stand against the elites to make sure that people at the bottom got enough. And that was the Democrats. The Republicans rose in the 1850s with a very different vision, and that was a vision that the world was a social web, if you will, that if people at the bottom did well, got educations, worked hard, they'd produce more than they could consume. And they would support a middle class, which would in turn support an upper class. And as the upper class did well, they would hire more people at the bottom.
Well, and we're reminded that Republicans, actually the very early Republicans, created the first national tax and then later were the anti-slavery activists.
And they created the Homestead Act, which put people on land. They created our first national college system. They were the ones who created our first national banking system and rested it on the people rather than the moneyed interests. They really did expand the government to try and create equality of opportunity. And they've done that a number of times throughout American history. Now, what happened is that in the 1930s, when FDR and the Democrats, I know that's a big leap there, but when they went ahead and used the federal government to do precisely that, a group of extremists said, no, we should not have the government involved in any way in regulating the economy, and they should not be involved in any kind of social welfare because government regulation will infringe on liberty, and taxes will redistribute wealth from hardworking Americans, generally white American men, and redistribute it through infrastructure, through schools, through hospitals, into minority populations, largely black people. And we must stop those things. And they called themselves movement conservatives. They are not traditional Republicans. They are movement conservatives.
Well, and you tell us these movement conservatives took over the party over decades, culminating in the 1990s under Newt Gingrich, when they purged the party of traditional Republicans, the people they called Republicans in name only.
rhinos.
In fact, it was a misnomer. It should have been the other way around. But when they took over the Republican Party and got rid of the traditional Rockefeller Republicans, if you will, Lincoln Republicans, when they read them out of the party, what they did is they wedded the party's machinery to this quite extremist idea that most Americans don't really believe. The moment we're in now, that movement conservative ideology has led to the Ted Cruz's and the Paul Ryans, yes. But what it's done is it's created a demographic that feeds the white nationalists, the hatred that most Americans don't really embrace.
Have they ever given rise to someone who really wasn't one of them?
No, and that's a very interesting distinction because Donald Trump is not a politician. He's a salesman. He's throwing stuff and seeing what works. And what he has discovered is that the movement conservatives have created a very specific demographic that will respond. They were playing with fire, and it is now burning them.
Are you saying that the Republican Party in the last, you know, half a century or more has created Donald Trump?
Yes, I am. And this is the moment when they say, wait, this is not our Republican Party. And this, I think, I'm one of the few optimistic people out there, is the moment that the Republican Party becomes the real Republican Party again.
Well, you write that the irony is that Donald Trump might be the unifier of the and the corrective element in the Republican Party. And you say, because people have been asking, is there any other time like this in history? And you say, actually, there is, 1884.
1884 is a great example. The Republican Party nominated a corrupt fellow, but he really was a politician. This is different in that that Donald Trump is really not himself a movement conservative. He is taking on and destroying the movement conservatives. But in 1884, what happened is the Republican Party nominated a corrupt senator that lots of people couldn't get behind, and Republicans jumped ship and voted in that case for the Democrat, for Grover Cleveland. But the Republicans who supported him convinced the ones who stayed behind to take the party back over and to rebuild it. And they were people like Teddy Roosevelt, Bob La Follette, who went ahead and created the Progressive Republican Party, which gave us Teddy Roosevelt in the Progressive Era. And I think we're looking at a very similar moment.
Huh. Well, but could you also argue that what will happen is that the Paul Ryans and the John McCains, the conservatives, wrestle the party back from Donald Trump and keep the conservative mantra from the last 40 years?
That is certainly the common wisdom right now. I think history suggests otherwise, that when you get a moment like this, you get the time when you've got the rank-and-file voters not agreeing with what the leadership of the party is doing, and there is now a demographic built that is willing to change the party and take it back. And not just on the Republican side, but also the Democratic Party is changing as well. It looks to me like, in fact, what we will see over the next, not even that long a time, next few years, the Republican Party rebuilding itself.
Well, but who gets it? Donald Trump has long been hinting that the elections are rigged. On Tuesday, his running mate Mike Pence was speaking with an unnamed supporter, scared of voter fraud, something Donald Trump speaks of a lot, even if there's little proof of any voter fraud. And then she said this about Hillary Clinton being elected.
I will tell you, from me personally, if Hillary Clinton gets in, I'm ready for a revolution because we can't have her in.
Yeah, you don't say
but that. I'm just saying it.
Professor Richardson, Heather Cox Richardson, we see there in that video, Mike Pence looks petrified. He says, you know, don't say that, don't say that. What is going to happen if Donald Trump wins and you have half of the party furious, or if he loses and you have the other half furious?
Well, historians are prophets of the past, not of the future. But we, again, have been in this very moment before. And it was, again, in the 1880s and the early 1890s when a group of Republicans committed to an ideology that looks much like movement conservatism said the same thing. If we don't win, the system is rigged. And the system is rigged by immigrants, by African Americans, by people who are un-American and who should be purged from society. And from that, we got very dramatic riots and lynchings where regular people stormed courthouses, stormed governments, took over governments until in 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina. Of course, we get the very famous Wilmington riot when a legitimate government was thrown out of office and replaced by a group of people who simply said, we don't care that it was legitimately elected. Those people who legitimately elected it should not be American voters.
Well, one would like to think that that's not where we're headed now. I mean, do you think there's another option of the Trump followers
followers breaking away, forming another party.
Yes, I think the Trump voters will do exactly that. They'll break away. But what he will have left behind in this last storm that he is creating around him is the destruction of the movement conservatives in the Republican Party. He is taking on Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and saying, you're coming down with me. And that destruction internally is pretty unprecedented for the leader of a party to go after his own party, unless you want to go back to Andrew Johnson after the Civil War, who took on his own party and did his best to destroy it. They ended up destroying him rather than the other way around. But this is not something we've really seen before in American history.
Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College. Again, her 2014 book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Heather, professor, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me here.
This week, HBO debuted a nightly news program. It's called Vice News Tonight, and it's a newscast that bucks the format of traditional nightly news. Here's a clip from last night's episode, which took viewers to the front lines of the conflict in Ukraine.
That's what the ceasefire sounds like here in Ukraine. Daily shelling, gunfire. One's just come right over our head and landed over there. The separatists are shelling from the distance. They're about 30 meters away. To be honest, this has just become a slow but constant battle.
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, we're obviously in the show's first week, but what are your initial thoughts?
Well, this show is kind of interesting because it's HBO's, as near as I can tell, it's HBO's first foray into a daily news show. And you sort of wonder what the purpose of it is. It's not a traditional newscast in the sense that it doesn't run down the day's headlines and tell you what everybody thinks it defines as news in that day. It's more like a news magazine show that airs every night. I would call it a nightline for millennials in an interesting way. But what that ends up doing is, like, they've had a couple of big interviews. They had John Boehner, former House Speaker, and they had conservative media icon Glenn Beck. And in both of those interviews, they didn't produce any news. They weren't particularly incisive. It was almost as if they were so thrilled that they actually had access to them that they didn't really ask them any real substantive questions, and they weren't that connected to the day's news, even though the one with Glenn Beck featured the reporter watching the last presidential debate with him in his home. But they do have some interesting stories that are talking about things that, you know, other news shows are not, including they had an interesting story about the ground game of Clinton and Trump in Florida, how they're each going to try to go about motivating voters. Something I hadn't seen before, and a look at how the patent fight between Samsung and Apple over smartphones might redefine patent law, which I also thought was kind of interesting and something I hadn't seen on television before. But I still don't think they quite know what they are yet, and too much of what I've seen, it doesn't seem relevant to the day's news, which I think a daily news show has to try to do.
Well, in addition to the substance, there are also stylistic differences here. There's no host of this show, and they use animation and stop motion visuals.
Yeah, I mean, this is the part of this show that I think is really great. You know, normally you have the voice of God anchor who kind of introduces, you know, every story. Certainly Nightline has that. They've dispensed with that. You get sort of a voiceover. You don't see really who's delivering it. They have a lot of cool, flashy-looking graphics that come in. In that story about the ground game for Clinton and Trump, when they described how Clinton's ground forces, her foot soldiers, would get data on voters and send it back to Clinton's HQ, they used an animation to sort of show, you know, pieces of paper going to one office and then going off to the home office. And it was a way of sort of visualizing what was going on. They also had stop motion animation taking apart a smartphone to show you the parts of the Samsung smartphone that Apple and Samsung are fighting over in their patent fight. And it just helped you very quickly understand a complex story. Hmm. So the look of it, I think, is very well crafted and serves their brand. But I still think they haven't yet come up with a substantive news program to build around it.
And let's talk about where they fit in on HBO. That network also has Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Let's listen to a clip of that. Here he is talking about Trump supporters and the now infamous tape from Donald Trump.
And all of you still thought he should be president. So the only way that you get to be shocked and outraged now is if you were cryogenically frozen until Friday afternoon, and that Access Hollywood tape was the first thing you saw upon being reanimated. Anything less than that, and this is on you too.
And then this is a clip from their show, long-running show, Real Time with Bill Maher.
Donald Trump and Mike Pence are making sexual assault great again. And this is a week where only just a few days ago, Donald Trump out on the stump accused Hillary Clinton with no evidence of cheating on Bill. Donald Trump, the only person he's ever been able to stay loyal to is Vladimir Putin.
Now, Eric, both of those shows that we just played clips from have a liberal bent to them. Does Vice fit into that as well? And is that a problem if HBO wants to be seen as a news source?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the first two big interviews that Vice had were with conservative figures, Glenn Beck and John Boehner. But certainly they pursue the social justice imperative in journalism. They want to be the voice of the voiceless. They want to stand up for the little guy. And sometimes that can feel like liberalism to some consumers. I think HBO is pretty safe with a show like Vice that has certainly featured conservatives in its reporting in a way that allows them to express their point of view fully and also yet try to cover things as a news outlet would.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.